Thank you for joining us on the Zesty Garden today. I'm Brian Earle, and in studio with me is Liz Fallis with Liz Fallis Catering here in Cache Valley. And Liz is well known throughout the area for pastries and goodies and different things that she produces, and I've sampled many of them. And we're going to talk today about Thanksgiving. And okay, so what does the Zesty Garden have to do with Thanksgiving? Well, there are a lot of vegetables connected with Thanksgiving and different ways of eating. And one of the things, Liz, that you sent to me email-wise yesterday was about how to eat gluten-free. And I had, since I don't have, as far as I know, gluten intolerance, I hadn't really thought along those lines about how that might, the Thanksgiving holiday might be for others. So tell me, how does Thanksgiving affect someone who cannot tolerate gluten?
Well, just a couple of things that you don't even think that flour are in, like the gravy in your turkey. Or sometimes people, you know, put breadcrumbs on things just as far as beans or something like that on top. So, you know, people who have, or even thickeners for soup, you know, people don't think of the little ingredients that are on the insides of some of the stuff that they make. You know, it's obvious, oh, cookies and cakes and bread have flour in them. So people remember gluten as part of that. But some of those other things, you know, people just don't think about it. And unless they're told, or the person that has a gluten intolerance has told them what kinds of things they can't eat, you know, people tend not to think about what's really on the inside, especially if they open up a can of something and just pour it on.
And there's so much that, unless you're really reading the label, can you actually see if it's going to have gluten in it even by reading the label?
Usually you can. The thing to look for these days, because they market it pretty well, is they really put gluten-free literally on the label, because it's been such a prevalent dietary concern lately. So, you know, if you know what to look for, the problem with some of the gluten things, just you wouldn't know, but soy sauce has gluten in it. So you have to go to things like tamari that don't have gluten. So if you're really going to stay gluten-free, it really a lot of research has to go into it to figure out what the labels say and what they mean.
And how is celiac disease different than the gluten intolerance? Are they kind of connected?
I believe they're connected, you know, not being a doctor, and I don't have these issues myself, so I, you know, haven't had people, too many people that I know have it, but some of the times when they have celiac disease, they also can't eat certain fresh fruits. Citrus and things like that can cause them problems, so they end up eating really a lot of rice, and sometimes potatoes, I know, bothers them. It really depends on the person.
Well, let's take a look at recipes for Thanksgiving that are going to be different, but those who have celiac disease or gluten intolerance would be able to use as well. And I grew up in a very traditional Thanksgiving family. My grandmother and my mother are great cooks, and I just love this holiday, but I always look forward to branching out and trying something different. And I was hearing on NPR the other day, well, you should try a turducken, or you should try some other meat. I'm like, no, it's gonna be
just want to do the turkey.
Just want to do the turkey.
Yeah.
But as far as the side dishes, that's where I would probably do a little bit of creative cooking.
Change up. Well, mm-hmm. And, you know, I also grew up in Canada, so some of the traditional things that you guys have down here, you know, like the green bean casserole, that is kind of foreign to me. I don't know. So, you know, opening cans of soup isn't usually my favorite thing to mix with stuff. And I don't know, I guess, you know, maybe it's a way to disguise vegetables so that a lot of people will eat their vegetables if it's disguised in other things. And so I don't know if that was what that was. Or wait, putting, was it marshmallows on top of your...
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to be getting into that, because looking back again at what I grew up with, I never remember my grandmother, other than maybe cranberry dressing, which I never liked
don't
that
like.
Stuff anyway. Never opened up a can. Everything was from scratch, and they started a couple of days ahead of time really getting things going.
Right, but you still, when you're making those things ahead of scratch, you know, with scratch, they're, you know, if we get back to the flour thing, if, you know, making just a simple cream sauce, flour is in that as far as thickeners go. So if we're going to be back a little bit more on the gluten-free thing, we can talk about cornstarch and some of the other, potato starch and rices. There's just a few different things out on the market these days. You can kind of think about putting that in so we're not quite so flour-friendly.
So when you're looking, start with gravy then. So as you're looking at that, can you, are those interchangeable one part to one part rather than using cornstarch? You using some of these other starches that are not gluten intolerant?
They do different things. They look a little different. You kind of have to do a little bit of experimenting what you like, but it usually tells you on the cornstarch package, you know, how much will thicken up, say, a cup of the particular liquid that you're using. The only problem I found with some of the cornstarches is that once you've made the gravy once, if you bring it back to a boil again, sometimes some of those other starches can fall apart a little bit and they don't stay quite as creamy as they might, say, if you're making the gravy with the flour base.
And what about different grains? Can you substitute? So if you have a gluten intolerance, you're not going to be using whole wheat.
Right.
But can you use things like... kamut?
You can. That's still a wheat, but it's an old grain wheat. I've made pastry with that before, and it is really difficult to work with because it doesn't have very much gluten in it, or maybe none at all, but it's kind of like making pastry out of sand. It kind of doesn't stick together very well. One of the other things that I've done, one of the recipes that I also sent to you yesterday was... fruit crisp, and you know, most people, it's one of the easier things to make. And the fruit, we usually put a little bit of flour in it to help thicken it. But instead, these days, I use tapioca. That's great with some of the soupier things, especially like a peach pie. I usually use tapioca and don't really put any flour in them anymore. And then when you use the topping, you know, it's usually been a mixture of brown sugar and flour and some cinnamon and butter mixed in to make the crumble. So instead, I had a reception that I had to do a couple weeks ago, and the lady is gluten intolerant. So I thought, well, how can I make flour? So I ground up oats in my food processor, add a little bit of rice flour, and then went on with the brown sugar and the butter, and then added some of the oats that weren't ground at the end to keep it, you know, looking more like the crumble on top. And it worked great. Nobody's going to know that there's no real flour in there, and the people who have flour digestive problems don't have to worry about it.
So the oats don't have gluten in them at all?
No, they can. Most people can eat those as a substitute. And rice is a big one. There's a whole bunch of other kinds of weird flours out there that they've started making that I have not really experimented with. There's like garbanzo bean flours and things like that. But you also notice there's some other strange ones, but they tend to be very expensive. And I don't need to go out and buy a super special flour for $10 a pound. You know, oats are really cheap. And if I grind them up in the food processor, they work fine for me for that. And rice flour is not very expensive either.
And if you're looking for an alternative to rice, I know for us, I'm not that big into white rice anymore. I adore quinoa.
So do I. I really do too.
Especially to red quinoa, but it's more expensive, so we don't it as often. But it's just, I just had it for lunch today, and I put spaghetti sauce on it rather than having the regular spaghetti.
I really like making salads out of quinoa, kind of like making a tabbouleh, so that it's just all the fresh vegetables in there with it. And then a nice lemon juice dressing with, and maybe add feta cheese, something like that. I love those kinds of combinations with the fresh tomatoes, which sadly are going out of season.
I have a third of a bucket left.
I have a few down on the floor in my garage, too. I walk by them, and a couple of them are turning a little black on corners where the deer chewed on them, and I'm thinking, oh, no.
They don't taste quite as good as if they had vine ripened, but they're still better than what you get in the store.
They're close, and you know they came from your garden, so that's good.
So that helps.
Yeah.
Well, so you just talked about salads, so let's look at some salads, and where are you going to find your best greens? Where can you get really good herbs this time of year to use in your cooking?
Good greens. Well, you know, I probably tend to stay away from the greens a little bit more when it comes to salads this time of year. I'll tend to go more for peppers, you know, putting peppers in things, like with your quinoa. That works absolutely perfectly. I've got another recipe that I think I sent you yesterday. It's a wild rice. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of people don't know what to do with wild rice because it takes a little while to cook, about as long as brown rice. But what I do is I use half wild rice and half white rice, mix them together, and then put in some colorful things. Any color bell peppers really work. I usually go for red and the yellow and the orange just because they taste sweeter. And then this particular recipe has Chinese pea pods in it, so that's kind of the green that you get. Sometimes that's a little seasonal, might depend what store you shop at for those. There's also chicken in here, which is one thing that I thought about including, because what do you do with some of that leftover turkey after Thanksgiving? So, you know, here's a salad. It says chicken, but why can't you use turkey instead? So
poultry.
Yeah, poultry, that works. This particular salad also, you could, I guess, use it without chicken if you wanted to be vegetarian. It is gluten-free because it's just got the rice in it and the vegetables. It also has pecans on for a garnish, which are kind of a nice crunch, a little bit of extra protein on there. And they're
kind of
pretty.
You can tell you're from Canada.
Uh-oh, did I say something?
Pecans.
Pecans. Okay. They're
pecans. And maybe it's a Utah thing. I'm always saying pecans.
Pecans.
So,
oh,
yeah.
I'm a pecan girl, I guess. I really like pecan pie. That's
but,
all
but when I have Dan Drost on the program, he'll say pumpkin.
So pumpkin. Like, I've heard him say pumpkin. It's pumpkin. Yes.
Maybe that's a Michigan thing.
I'm not sure.
Okay. So I got us off
anyway,
topic.
There's pecans in the wild rice and chicken salad.
And do you roast them?
Toast them a little bit, okay, in the oven. And I have sometimes a hard time not over toasting them. So be very, very careful with pecans. It might be because they're a little bit... maybe the oil in there likes to burn more quickly. There's more times I've turned around for just a minute and all of a sudden my pecans are black.
So how long? What temperature and how long?
Oh, so just a medium oven, like at 350, but I would check them after about 4 minutes. You know, like not very long at all.
So just taste them. They taste really good. Take them out.
Well, you can do that too, yeah, and if they look like they're going just a little bit browner, okay, you really don't want them to go.
And right now, pecans are cheaper than walnuts, which just blows my mind. You know, when I was in the store this last week, and they were like $2 less for the same 3-pound package, and it's just crazy to me.
So. Yeah, pick the nuts that are best in season, I guess. I guess they should all be coming in season.
Mm-hmm.
This is the time where they pick them off the trees in California and stuff like that.
Soups? Let's talk about soup. You've got a butternut soup recipe, and all three of these are now on our website, so that if you want to go check them out, go to upr.org, click on programs, and go to Zesty Garden, and you'll be able to find them. Liz Fallis with Liz Fallis Catering is in studio with me today, and we're talking about Thanksgiving cooking. And so butternut soup.
So this is a butternut and apple soup, and it's another one that is gluten-free. And one of the nice things about soup, especially when they're a puree, this is a pureed soup, that you can really use the vegetables that are in them to be the thickeners. And it really helps to bring out the flavors if you roast them ahead of time. So this is a roasted butternut squash. And then after it's cooked, you scoop out the squash from its skin. And then mix it with the apples and all the spices and cook it until everything's really soft, and then blender. And the other good thing about these soups is that you can make them ahead of time and just have them ready, especially if you have lots of people coming.
Can you freeze them?
You know, this one doesn't have any milk or anything. I've not frozen it. But yeah, I couldn't imagine that this wouldn't be a problem at all.
So the apple is used to just sweeten it a little bit?
Yeah, just a nice little extra flavor in there, cooking it in. So yeah, I really enjoy the apples.
And how many does this one feed?
This is a really large, a really large one. So, you know, I usually use it for my luncheons when I'm serving, you know, maybe 20 ladies or something like that. So if you don't, you'll notice in here it calls for four quarts of stock, and that's a gallon. And in addition to everything else in there, it kind of gives, you need a really large pot. So it'd be really easy to have it, or probably even quarter it. And it also, in the recipe, it calls for 6 pounds of butternut squash. And I was using the squash from my garden a couple of weeks when I was cooking it, and it was one really rather large one, and then, you know, one pretty medium. And it was a lot of squash, and I think by the time I ended up cooking it all, it wasn't even quite 6 pounds.
Oh my.
So, and depends on the store, but if you have to buy your butternut, they can be a little bit pricey too.
So don't buy it according to the poundage in the store. So like if you buy one that's like 8 pounds in the store, you might end up with only 4 pounds?
You'd probably end up with more than that. The seeds,
okay.
Seeds in the middle probably don't weigh, you know, that much. But yeah, that's true. If you buy a 6 pound squash, it's not going to give you 6 pounds of squash after you've cooked it. It's probably going to be, you know, 3/4, I would think, something like that.
It's interesting. Growing up, I just
hated squash.
And I, to this day, I still cannot eat Hubbard. My mother just adored Hubbard squash. Yeah. And I'm not a big banana squash person. Mm-hmm. I like the smaller squashes, like the buttercup.
Or acorn.
Buttercup's my favorite. And they last so long. I had them until March. Last year.
Yeah, the other one that I have that I grew this summer in my garden was the spaghetti squash. And I absolutely adore those because you can cook them in the oven or even in the microwave and scoop them out. And they look like spaghetti, put a little bit of butter, and some people put the tomato sauce on.
I was going to say, I do that and the quinoa together.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just so, so good. And it's so much better. To me, it just tastes better than doing the regular noodle thing.
Spaghetti.
And it's getting me away from the simple carbs.
Right, that's true.
So I did want to ask one more question on the butternut soup. So you said it requires 4 quarts of stock. Can you have an issue with stock, with gluten?
Yeah, you can. So that's when you have to read your labels again. And often if you're interested in looking for alternative places, go to the health foods sections of the stores, because they'll be the places where they say they're either gluten-free or not. Because I think it's modified food starch is what they see on the side of the containers, and that's a no-no for gluten people. So that's, but it doesn't say flour, so you have to kind of know all the nomenclature.
Mm. So what kind of stock? Is it like a chicken stock?
It kind of depends. Whether you want to be a vegetarian, you can just get regular vegetarian stock, or you could get chicken stock. You know, your choice, really.
And if you're going to have a turkey, I mean, that's a perfect opportunity to...
You could make your own stock.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly.
You wouldn't be able to use it for your... Unless you did it the night, prepared it the night before or something, but...
Yeah, I don't know how many people make their own stocks anymore, but... You know, even if you get one of those rotisserie chickens from the grocery store, and after one of those, just put it in a pot, you know, put some onions in there and cover it some water and let it boil down.
And that's enough?
An instant stock, yeah.
And you can you freeze this?
Oh, for sure.
Okay. And how long does it last?
Oh, a long time. Even lasts for a long time. Usually what happens if you pour it into like canning jars, and if there's a little bit of fat on top, it kind of seals it in anyway. So it really will last a long time, especially if you kind of do it like the canning way, so that you pour it in hot and it seals itself in months.
I wanted to make sure I asked you about what I grew up thinking were yams, which are really sweet potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Another one of those things that I just wouldn't touch as a kid. I was okay with marshmallows, but I just, the yams and the marshmallows and the brown sugar.
Just too much sugar for you?
I think so. I think that was part of it, but part of it was just, it looked like a squash, so I didn't want to eat it.
Yeah.
So, but now I just adore roasted sweet potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
We'll make French fries out of them at home.
Yeah, that's a great way
just
to do it.
Just a little bit of oil and just bake them. And they're so good. So how would you change this traditional recipe to make it more healthy and probably taste better?
Well, because my kids like mashed potatoes so much, I just tend to mash them at the same time. So there's two different choices of mashed tubers on your table. So, and you can add a little bit of brown sugar in there if you want to. Of course, butter tastes better. So I would just do that. In the past, I've also just done kind of like you've done slice them and then layer them in like a casserole dish and then just put a little bit of butter and brown sugar on them, kind of bake them that way. It looks a little bit different. It's not like you're putting marshmallows or something on top. But I guess I'm sort of going to do the mash thing because it's the easiest for me. But roasting is great. Actually, one of the other ways I've done it, but it's not your traditional Thanksgiving dinner if you want to be roasting. I often do half like Yukon Gold potatoes and half sweet potatoes and roast them with a few shallots and olive oil in the oven. Now that's tasty. So, but not a lot of people want that kind of potato for Thanksgiving, or it's something you could, you know, try as a new tradition.
For us, it was never really Thanksgiving unless we had my grandma's lumpy mashed potatoes. It's like, where's the lumps? These aren't real. Because now you can get them, so they're pretty much instant. I can't remember what you call them. Through the LDS Church, you can get these
potato
canned,
bud things.
The pearls. Yeah, potato pearls.
I'm sorry, but they taste bad to me. Yeah. I don't care for this.
Yeah, add so much butter. It's like, why even do it?
Yeah.
So.
I think they might be good for camping. You know, you're out in the middle of the bushes.
Food storage.
But not in your house. But no, my favorite with mashed potatoes, I actually just throw a couple of cloves of garlic in with the boiling water with the potatoes and drain them a little bit, not all the water out, you know, just add some butter and milk and salt and pepper, and those are the best garlic potatoes around.
What would you say is your favorite vegetable then for Thanksgiving?
Well, I do like cranberry sauce, but those aren't vegetables, are they?
Have you tried who's the NPR personality that has the flaming pink-colored, I was going to say Barbara Stanwyck. It's not Barbara Stanwyck. It's Susan Stamberg. Mm. She has this recipe for cranberry sauce that uses, it's like hot, zesty pink is how it eventually comes out.
Oh, does she put lots of chili peppers or something in it?
I think so.
Or red peppercorns or pink peppercorns.
Yeah,
I don't know, like
that. Okay, so
my favorite way is just to boil my own cranberries and just put an orange in with it and boil it with the orange and then let it set up just so it's an orange one.
Mm.
But that's just me. I love that on the sandwiches the next day too. That's really when it's more fun. But as far as vegetables, we probably just go more standard and just the broccolis and the cauliflowers alongside. And you can either do simple and steam. You could bake them in the oven. Sometimes you could do cauliflower with getting into the gluten world and put your breadcrumbs on top that way. Or if you're into having green beans, they have lots of little slender green beans, the haricot vert that the French have named, which just means green beans, but you know, steam those. You can actually roast them and sometimes put a little bit of maybe a lemon vinaigrette. That works really well.
Asparagus seems to be the choice of vegetable in our family. Do you have any
in November?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
If we can find them in the store. And I'm always looking for spears. Usually they might be a little bit wrinkled. It's like, okay, I just avoid them altogether. But
right.
I did find some a couple of days ago.
I did see some in the store yesterday, too, when I was at one of the local places.
So,
but I don't know. Asparagus isn't my fall vegetable. I really think more of it as a spring vegetable.
It is, and it really is.
So.
But when you can find it, it's spring somewhere on the globe. So
I guess that's true.
It's not local, though, and that's right. Really what I like to do is eat as local as as possible.
Well, and it tastes better, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
If you've got to fly a vegetable or a fruit halfway around the world, they just have to make those more worthy of travel these days, and they're not often the most flavorful of that particular variety. So, yeah, I don't know. Asparagus isn't going to be on my Thanksgiving
meal.
It's
like we like to roast it, toss it with a little bit of olive oil, and toast.
Balsamic vinegar really is one of my favorite things. So if I'm doing that, I'd love to do dressings with a little bit of balsamic vinegar and then some, maybe more of a specialty olive oil too. Just, you know, go a little bit more expensive, some little bit nicer farms. just nicer flavors.
Toasted pine nuts, maybe.
Yeah, you could do that too.
Okay, I'm really hungry right now. All right, so the last thing I wanted to ask you, and we talked a little bit about your fall fruit crisp, but why don't you describe that recipe and how to prepare it?
Okay, so this was the way I've kind of devised it to be gluten-free, because the crisp topping is made with oats and rice and not flour. The fillings of these particular desserts really can, you can put any fruit that you've got around in the house. This particular recipe is equal amounts of apples and pears. So you could do all apples, you could do all pears. If you, you know, happen to have anything else around, and it doesn't really matter what kind of apples. Sometimes I use two or three different kinds of apples.
And so you don't necessarily need one that's really sweet or
no,
one that's really tart.
I mostly use crisps just because I have an abundance of whatever fruit happens to be, and it's, you know, it's a great way to do that. I tend to peel my apples, but I don't peel my pears. So you could also, I think when I do my apples, I prefer not to have the apple skins in the dessert itself. But with the pears, I really haven't had a problem with that. So I would just slice the apples after peeling, but the pears I would just slice, you know, with their pear skins on. And then what I do is I add craisins. And I think that's a nice, fun kind of little tart sweet at the same time. Adds a little bit of difference in there. And then again, using the gluten-free, I use tapioca in the mixture. And then add some cinnamon and honey to do the sweet. So you can see, you know, what kind of basic ingredients and measurements online if you look up the recipe. But I don't know, I have about a quarter cup of honey. I tend to, if I'm going to use sugar, I kind of use a basis that I don't use more than 3/4 of a cup of white sugar in a pie. A lot of pies call for a cup or more, and that's always way too sweet for me. I'd much rather the fruit shine through and not the sugar shine through. So, and then also, because the topping in a crisp has sugar in it, you don't really need as much sugar in the bottom either. You make it a little bit more tart, and there's a nice balance between the topping and the fruits on the bottom. And then again, the topping, you know, just grind up the oats, add some rice flour. I've kind of in the past thought about equal amounts of, you know, oats and equal amounts of sugar. It's almost equal amounts of butter when you come up to doing the measuring. And when I do most of my recipes, I actually weigh. I do not use a lot of recipes that I use a cup of this and a half a cup of that and 3 cups of that. I really tend to do ounces and pounds. That way it's much more precise when you're doing your baking.
Because it can be a big difference, even though you may measured it and leveled it and so forth.
Yeah, you could scoop out 6 different cups of flour and all 6 would weigh something different. Sugar's a little different. You know, sugar's going to scoop pretty much the same, but things like brown sugar are going to scoop way different each time because it's compactable. So, yeah, so that's why in the recipes that you'll find online, they all have ounces. So, sorry, go out and buy a scale. It really does make your life easier in the end, and consistency, that's what it's really good for.
And your recipes, again, will be consistent from time to time.
They will. And if there's something a little bit wrong, it's easier to chase it down. Like a couple of weeks ago when I forgot to put baking soda in. Okay. I make those mistakes once in a while too.
Liz, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, you're very welcome, Brian. It's fun.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Liz Fallis with Liz Fallis Catering has been in the studio. Coming up next is Nancy Williams and Petals and Prose. We hope you'll stay with us.
Get the family involved and look for fun, quick, and easy ideas for decorating your Thanksgiving or fall dinner table. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Create a quick and edible centerpiece with seasonal apples. Place them in a low decorative container, overturn a small rustic basket, and have them spill onto the table, or scatter them on colorful fall leaves down the middle of the table. Use 1 or 2 small pumpkins as a flower vase for your favorite fall flowers, or break out your tiered dessert tray. Fill it with acorns, colorful leaves, twigs, and fall flowers. And don't forget to look for seasonal fruits and vegetables in your region while grocery shopping. Acorn and other winter squash can fill in for pumpkins. Pomegranates, persimmons, and kumquats, combined with large glossy leaves and a few colorful napkins, are sure to grab the attention of your guests. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams for Petals and Prose, and I would like to talk today about birds because I'm, in addition to being a beekeeper, I'm a birder. And so I'm particularly fond of this one book that I've been sharing much from by Sue Hubble called A Country Year, Living the Questions. She's also a birder and a beekeeper on a much larger scale than I am. So this is a chapter that she writes about what people do when they're beekeepers in the winter, and she's talking about the wealth of birds that she's enjoying, and that's what we typically enjoy so much in the winter as well. Hers are just a little different because she's writing from the Midwest, and actually from upstate New York, farther east than the Midwest. So she has different birds than we do, but they're very interesting. Here's what she says. She says, I am rich in birds today, especially in bluebirds and cedar waxwings. The bluebirds, eastern bluebirds to be precise, nest here less and less during the summer, but they congregate in flocks in winter. Brilliant blue, with rust-colored breasts and white bellies, they've been here for over a month eating sumac berries and the fruit of the pepperidge tree that grows all around the cabin, chittering contentedly to one another as they feed. The waxwings, however, are erratic visitors, and never before have I had them in such numbers or in such steady attendance. I have been seeing and hearing them for several weeks now. Today, after 3 days of rain and sleet, which made it hard for them to feed, the sun rose in a clear sky, and not long afterward I could hear the tsee-tsee of the cedar waxwings in the trees. I had spent the past days of sleety weather inside the cabin labeling honey jars, a necessary but boring job, and I too was glad to see the sunshine. I put on a jacket, hung my binoculars around my neck, and went out to watch the waxwings. There must have been hundreds of them visible in the bare treetops. I could hear them everywhere. The bluebirds were perched on the power lines and separately in their own trees, although here and there I could see one among the cedar waxwings. Goldfinches in dull winter plumage were flying between trees in swooping flight, singing as they do in the summertime on each dip. Cardinals, chickadees, and nuthatches were jostling one another at the feeder. On the ground, which was still covered with frost in the shadows of the barn and outbuildings, juncos, small, trim, neat gray and white birds, were scratching for weed and grass seeds so earnestly that they did not even fly up as I walked among them. I went out into the field. Bluebirds were singing on all sides, calling back and forth quizzically, "Chewee! Chewee!" I could also hear cedar waxwings from over by the barn, and through my binoculars I could see that they were settling down to feed in the little persimmon grove. The persimmon tree flowers in June, when the bees work the blossoms for nectar, in such buzzing numbers that when I'm walking in the woods I can hear a persimmon grove a long time before I see it. The fruit the bees help to set is smaller than the oriental persimmons that you find in specialty markets, but it is tasty and high in sugar content after it's ripe. It ripens late, not until after frost. Before that, it's bitter and acrid. I once bit into one too soon. My mouth puckered immediately, and the astringent effect lingered on into the next day. But ripe persimmons are sweet and flavorful, and I had intended to shake down the fruit of those trees in back of the barn and make a pie from them for a couple who are friends. The wife is an excellent cook, but she told me once that pies are beyond her, and although she likes to eat them, she can't make them. I am no cook at all, but I rather fancy making pies when I have someone to make them for, because they look so pretty when they're finished. I was invited to dinner with my friends, and I was going to take them a persimmon hickory nut pie as a surprise. But the cedar waxwings needed the persimmons more than my friends needed a pie, so I'm glad I never got around to shaking the fruit from the tree. I went up into the barn loft for a closer look. The new storage loft put me right at the level of the tops of the young trees, and the windows allowed me a close look without disturbing the birds. They were feeding so greedily, however, that I doubt if I could have disturbed them anyway. Cedar waxwings are sleek, elegant birds, crested and brownish-backed. Their bellies are creamy white. A bright band of yellow tips their tails, and their wings are banded in red. A black band runs from the beak top around their eyes to the back of their head, giving the party in the persimmon trees the air of a masked ball. One of my bird books calls them, fancifully, birds of mystery. This is because they're wanderers. Out of breeding season, they are social birds who congregate in such big groups that they quickly deplete the food in any one spot, so they're always on the move. They appear one day in numbers, eat everything, insects when they can find them, fruit of any kind, dogwood berries, and like the bluebirds, sumac and pepperidge, and then they fly on, not to be seen again. Their presence here for nearly a month seems highly unusual, but this was a good year in these parts for that kind of thing that cedar waxwings like to feed on, and even now there is still plenty for them to eat. Thomas Nuttall, the 19th century eccentric whose name was given to more species of plants and animals than any other naturalist, claimed cedar waxwings were excessively polite to one another. He said he had often seen them passing a worm back and forth down a whole row of beaks before it was finally eaten. I would enjoy seeing this, but I never have. Today, the birds I was watching from the loft were ravenously hungry after the days of bad weather, and though they did not take persimmon from one another, so that in a sense their behavior might be called polite, they did not pass food around either. Instead, each bird chose a single persimmon, tore at the skin to get to the soft, sweet pulp inside, gobbled it down in big lumps, and then hopped to another free persimmon to gorge again. They were feeding so intently that they stopped calling to one another. I watched them for a long time until their hunger stilled, and they flew off to a different tree, where I could see them through the binoculars, preening and sunning, and hear them socializing sibilantly, tsee, 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 in a satisfied way. If there had been persimmons for me, this is the recipe for the pie I would have made. 1 graham cracker crumb crust. You can buy that in the store. 1/2 cup of brown sugar. 1 envelope of unflavored gelatin. 1/2 teaspoon of salt. 3 eggs separated. 2/3 cup milk. 1 cup of strained wild persimmon pulp. 1/4 cup of sugar. 1/4 cup of chopped hickory nuts. And heavy cream for whipping. Simple instructions. In a saucepan, combine the brown sugar, gelatin, and salt. Beat the egg yolks lightly and add to the milk. Stir the liquid into the brown sugar mixture and cook all of it, stirring constantly, until the mixture is thoroughly heated and the sugar is melted. Avoid boiling. Remove it from the heat and stir in the persimmon pulp. Chill for approximately 1 hour or until soft mounds form when the mixture is dropped from a spoon. Beat the egg whites until soft peaks appear. Add the sugar gradually, beating until stiff. Stir the hickory nuts into the chilled persimmon mixture and fold into the beaten egg whites. Turn into the crumb crust and chill until firm, and serve with sweetened whipped cream. If you'd like to see that recipe, it's on the website, upr.org, under the Zesty Garden tab. Bon appetit if you decide to do that. Let me know. I'm Nancy Williams with Petals and Prose.
Hello and welcome to this portion of the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and for the last few minutes of the program, about 13 or 14 minutes, we're going to talk with Brooke Cordray. She's a certified holistic nutrition educator with Slow Food Utah. She also has her own website called Cosmo Hippie Chef. And we're going to continue our conversation about Thanksgiving and the dishes of Thanksgiving and nutrition and the vegetables. And we hope that you'll join our conversation. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Hi, Brooke. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Do you know, as I have looked at Thanksgiving recipes, the number one thing as I think about my own Thanksgiving experiences are how can I make mine more healthy? And number one for me is I could always cut my portions, but then that's half the fun.
It's true. It's true. You know, in our last class with Wasatch Community Gardens, we did a Thanksgiving-themed class, And I tried to make sure that there was something on the menu for everyone. So we had a raw cranberry relish. We had a local brined turkey. We did a raw kale and root veggie salad. We did the mashed potatoes and gravy completely vegan for maybe a family member who, you know, isn't eating any animal products. And we also did a mix between a pumpkin pie and a cream cheese tart of a sense, but we used goat cheese instead of cream cheese to kind of, you know, not overdo it on the fat content. But I think adding a lot more vegetables is helpful, using, you know, as fresh of ingredients as you can get your hands on.
So what's the number one thing someone can do to, if you want to jazz up your Thanksgiving just a little bit as far as the food, what's the number one thing that you recommend someone to do that's maybe not too difficult, but can sure make a difference?
Geez, that's a, I think adding toasted nuts to, say, sautéed Brussels sprouts is a fun way to add a little crunch, add a little extra flavor. You know, that cranberry relish I was talking about, that's a raw cranberry relish. It's easy to make in the food processor, and we serve that over goat cheese. And, you know, goat cheese is a little bit healthier of an option than cream cheese, but it's got great pungent flavor. You know, your previous guest, when you guys were talking about how to do things that are gluten-free, last year I tricked my husband, and he loves the you know, marshmallow-covered sweet potatoes. So I made mine kind of into a crumble, and I used oats, like your previous guest had mentioned, and walnuts, and maple syrup, and just to give it some texture and something a little bit different than just the traditional roasted marshmallows on top.
And he liked it?
I still had to put the marshmallows on top, but he did eat it, so that's good.
Okay. Well, you mentioned Brussels sprouts, so let's start with that vegetable. That's
okay.
Not one that I would normally think of traditional for Thanksgiving or to include it, but I've also grown them and noticed the difference between the ones that I grew and when I grew them correctly. I mean, most people think, oh, they're sulfury tasting. I just don't like the flavor. So how would you prepare Brussels sprouts?
Well, two ways. I like to roast them in the oven with a little bit of olive oil and salt and pepper. And then you can finish them with a squeeze of lemon and maybe some shredded Parmesan, some grated Parmesan. I have a friend who lives in France now, and she actually turned me on to this recipe where she would cut them very finely. Actually, a local restaurant down here in Salt Lake, they do this something similar, and you know, kind of shred them in a sense and saute them with lots of garlic and salt and pepper and either butter or olive oil. And just at the end, you throw in some chopped pistachios. And this is great. That's how we had ours last year, and it was fantastic. And I agree with you. They're not really traditional for most people, but for me, I try to have at least one green thing on the table during Thanksgiving.
So why do we not like Brussels sprouts? Is it the way we cook them, or is it that we're not selecting the correct ones when we're in the store? What should we be looking for when we're purchasing them?
Well, a couple things. I mean, I'm with you. I did not grow up on Brussels sprouts, and I think Brussels sprouts when I were a kid were in a frozen bag, and I don't remember my parents eating them a lot, but maybe a few times, and we never touched them. But they are a staple in my house this time of year. They tend to show up a little bit early in the supermarket, so sometimes if you're buying them out of season, you're right, they will be a little bitter. But this time of year, they're more of a cold weather crop, so you'll be seeing them now. But, you know, I got some at our winter farmers market 2 weeks ago. I think choosing those certain vegetables in their season, like you were talking about asparagus. Asparagus is really a spring vegetable, and I think a lot of people tend to not like it when they buy it out of season because it doesn't taste right. So this is the right season for Brussels sprouts. They're very easy. You just trim the ends, pull off any leaves that look like they need to be discarded, and like I said, either roast them or saute them, and They're a great veggie any time of year, but especially at Thanksgiving.
I loved your suggestion about roasting them with olive oil. That's what we've done with ours, and I tend to like the smaller ones instead of the much bigger ones.
Yes, if you buy them bigger, you know, you might want to quarter them instead of just cutting them in half.
Okay, let's take a let's go to mashed potatoes. This was one that someone had asked me about. I'm like, I have no idea. Don't you just cook the potato and then mash it up with a little bit? I have no idea. But I always ate my grandmother's mashed potatoes that I mentioned before.
Yes.
What's the best way to get it just to the right consistency? I mean, I'm always going to do them mashed. I've got the masher. That's a job for one of my kids or for me, you know, whatever. But I want to do something just a little bit different as well. Should you use two different types of potatoes, or is one kind better than another?
Well, I tried two different kinds for my class that I just did with Wasatch Community Gardens. I did one version with potatoes and cauliflower and parsnips. That one was just okay. I did mash it. I actually tend to like a more, I know some people really love the really fluffy, smooth mashed potatoes. I like mine a little bit more rustic. So I kind of like mine just, you know, a good mashing is fine for me. But the version we ended up with for my class was we did russet potatoes and parsnips. Parsnips are a really fun winter veg. They are slightly sweeter. They kind of look like a carrot, but they have a very distinct flavor. So if you're a very traditional potato person, you might not love the parsnips in there, but my class seemed to like them. And we used, you know, 2 pounds of potatoes to one pound of parsnips, and we just boiled them together. And like your previous guest said, I do the same thing. I throw a few cloves of garlic in, and you just drain off a little bit of the water and give it a hearty mash. This class, we didn't use butter or milk because we were trying to make the potatoes vegan friendly. So I just used olive oil and salt and pepper. And you save a little bit of the cooking water if you need a little bit of moisture, and they turned out perfect.
Should you use more of a russet, or can you go with a Pontiac?
I prefer a russet potato. But, you know, you can also use a potato ricer. I don't know if you've heard of this tool. I have one. It's small, so it takes me a while to process all of those potatoes. So that's why I just stick to my masher. But a potato ricer will kind of, make it a little bit smoother and a little fluffier. But I tend to just stick to a good old russet potato.
Okay, what about beans? It seems like at our Thanksgiving table, my grandmother's always had this recipe for, I don't remember the name of it, but we kept them long, and it was some kind of a hollandaise sauce that she would dribble over just a spoon over the top. And then I got to take the hard boiled egg yolk and just gently use almost like a zester and scrape that a little bit, so it would just kind of sprinkle over the top. And I just, I love this stuff. It's just really good. What would you suggest for beans?
You know, it's funny. I hate to say this because I love all vegetables. I'm not a huge green bean fan. So we did grow up them. My mom always pickled them with onions, like did a quick pickle. And that's the only way I would eat green beans as a kid. But I know everybody this time of year likes kind of the more green bean casserole. I guess I'm just not, that's not a good question for me because I don't love beans. I'm sorry. I feel bad about that. But I love all vegetables except for I'm just not a huge green bean fan.
No, my kids, I was going to say, my kids haven't told me if they don't like green beans because we've got 80 feet of row that we grow every year and can and eat them all winter long. So I guess they like them.
The fresher ones are obviously better. And like I said, growing up in the summertime when we had beans, my mom, the way she made them, I loved them that way.
So dilly beans?
Yeah, they're kind of. I mean, they're, you know, she just left them in the fridge. They had, red wine vinegar and some onion. And I just loved them that way. So if I was going to make them, that's probably how I would make them.
Now, what about beets? Now, my family's going to argue about this one because I'm the only one that likes to eat beets.
Okay.
But how would you prepare beets?
I like to roast mine. I'll usually, you know, just line a baking sheet pan with parchment. And I tend to not wrap mine in foil. You can do that. I like to just put them on the parchment paper and just roast them until they're nice tender, which means you just poke your knife in, and as if they slide off, they're tender, and you let them come out and cool, and the skin will come off very easily. And you know, goat cheese and walnuts and beets go really well together. And I think with just a nice, you know, mustard vinaigrette, they're just perfect that way.
I'm going to branch away here from vegetables just a little bit, because I just have to ask, do you get the perfect roll?
Oh, rolls. Okay. So last year, every year I try to add something new that I need to teach myself in the kitchen, and bread was kind of the thing last year. So I actually am already starting to think about the loaves of bread I need to bake for my husband to make turkey sandwiches. This is going to sound really silly. I don't do rolls on Thanksgiving. I know, but this is why. I feel like we have so many other carbohydrates on Thanksgiving that I save the fresh rolls or the fresh bread for the next day to make the sandwiches. I know this is not a traditional thing, but when you have the stuffing and the sweet potatoes and the mashed potatoes, for me, I feel like it's an overload. So I tend to wait and make fresh loaves of bread for the next day to make those, unforgettable turkey sandwiches on.
Okay, so
I'm sorry, Brian. That's probably not the answer you wanted. But
if you're ever at my house for Thanksgiving and you don't eat the orange rolls that I make, then I'll understand why.
Oh, listen. I mean, I would never turn one away. I just don't go to the extra effort on that day.
Well,
I usually wait till the next day.
Really, and for some, I don't know how my grandmother and my mother did it. It's just like they did everything, and we were just the kids not paying a whole lot of attention. So that's one of those things that you can cut out that just takes a lot of work that you can do on another day when you have a little more time.
It's true. The day before, or like I said, for me, it's a little easier to do it the next day. And the last couple Thanksgivings where we've had, rolls, I've actually ordered them from a local bakery just to kind of lighten my load a little bit.
And in the last 60 seconds that we've got, what would be your number one dessert?
Well, this year I am branching out. I am going to do my Thanksgiving's pretty healthy. I am going to make a walnut maple cake with a cream cheese frosting.
Mm.
Yeah.
That sounds really good. What do you normally have? Do you do the pie thing or?
I've normally done a pumpkin, a maple roasted sweet potato cheesecake.
Mm.
That's what I've made the last few years, but I'm just kind of feeling like I want to try something different this year.
And what's your address?
Oh, right. Okay, yes. You're more than welcome to call for a feed.
Well, you've been listening to Brooke Cordray. She's a certified holistic nutrition educator with Slow Food Utah. She also has her own website called Cosmo Hippie Chef. Brooke, thank you so much for joining us today on the Zesty
Garden. Oh, Brian, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll have you again. And thank you to our listeners for joining us on today's Zesty Garden.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.